afternoon and welcome to the American Security Project. Today we are very honored to have Ambassador Don Baer, who has recently been in Switzerland and Liechtenstein as the United States Ambassador. And previously was 8 years as Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And he's a well-known business and political leader in the state and the region around here. The American Security Project was founded in 2006 by then Senators Kerry, Hart, Hagel, and Rudman to look at national security issues from a strategic perspective. And part of our mission is to look at public diplomacy and how that affects our national security, how we listen, how we communicate, and how we influence foreign audiences. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Ambassador, who is going to give us an insight from the Ambassador's chair.
Good afternoon. Thank you for spending lunch with me. It's a great honor to be part of this. I've gotten to be friends with Paul and General Cheney in the last couple of months, and this is really my first opportunity to interact with the American Security Project, so thank you. I want to highly recommend the experience of being a U.S. ambassador if you get the chance. It was never anything that I aspired to. I mean, we worked full-time on the Obama campaign and have been deeply involved in politics, but it was a surprise when the White House called and said, the President wants you to go to Switzerland. But it was just a wonderful experience, enriching and fulfilling in so many different ways. For example, the leadership substance alone. I tend to be a policy wonk, and I really like the idea of leader as change agent, leader that makes things different than they were. So having a chance to work on Turkey-Armenia normalization of relations after almost 100 years, on Russia's accession to the WTO, on resettling Guantanamo detainees, on enhancing and enforcing Iran sanctions, especially Switzerland, trying to get Switzerland not to be the hole in the donut on Iran sanctions within Europe, on citizenship renunciations. Switzerland, the whole time I was there, not only led the world in U.S. citizenship renunciations, but did more than the rest of the world combined. And trying to get imprisoned American citizens out of Iraq. The three hikers, right now, a young man named Hekmati, and so much more. It was very fulfilling every day to wake up and have an agenda that was full of meaningful things. The friendships were another huge part of the experience. And then the experiences themselves. You know, I'm a lifelong Washingtonian. I grew up in the Palisades. And having a chance to sort of blow up your life and go over to be able to ski and hike and climb in the Alps was really a wonderful thing. Yeah, as ambassador, there are three essential duties. The first is the traditional diplomacy, government to government. And that took up most of the traditional work day. We got a chance to work on all the different immigration or the different Swiss initiatives, initiative and referendum. Switzerland is certainly the country in the world that most relies on initiative and referendum. It's the most decentralized political system in the world, where politics is actually at the village level and slowly works its way up to the Federal Council. We may talk a little bit later about the Swiss initiative on Sunday to limit immigration from the other Schengen states. We did lots and lots of intelligence sharing, for example, as part of this traditional diplomacy. In Switzerland, espionage is illegal. It's one of the few things you can do as a diplomat to get thrown out of Switzerland. So as good Americans, we respected that. And the intelligence officials we had there, for example, the defense attachés, their primary purpose was to communicate with the Swiss intelligence services all that we had learned in the rest of the world. And once again, it was very interesting and deep and good friendships. And also law enforcement. We had two FBI agents there, once again sharing criminal information from around the world with Swiss foreign law enforcement leadership. The highlight or the low light of that experience was probably the arrest of Roman Polanski in September of 2009, as he came to achieve the Lifetime Achievement Award in film from the Zurich Film Festival. And we spent much of the rest of the year trying to get him extradited to Los Angeles, unsuccessfully. The second big piece of the role of ambassador is economic statecraft. Switzerland was the number one foreign direct investor in the United States in 2010, number two in 2011. It's literally billions of dollars of Swiss revenue, Swiss assets, that flow into U.S. companies and U.S. jobs every year. A lot of this was reducing barriers to trade. And we would find out from American companies or Swiss companies representing American products what those barriers to trade were, and then working with the Swiss government to reduce them. Understanding company issues. We had more than 700 American companies operating in Switzerland. I didn't visit all 700, maybe only 110 of them, but it was very helpful to go visit with them and understand what they needed to grow internationally and what we needed to do here to have them grow more jobs in the United States. Export controls was another big issue that whole time, and just lots and lots of economic statecraft. Towards the end, I realized that visiting with the big Swiss companies too, the Holcim's of the world, Hilti and Liechtenstein, and their investments in the United States was also a critical part of our economic growth. The whole time I was there, the number one domestic priority for President Obama and his team was trying to get the unemployment rate down from 10% to where it is now. So anything we could do to contribute to that was helpful. And finally, to Paul's point, there was public diplomacy. Instead of government to government, people to people. And this for us was the most fun, because instead of going from government office, we got to go from village to village and finding the right balance. Before we went over, I read a fascinating survey of foreign service officers who said they were ranking the various responsibilities of the ambassador, the chief of mission. And career foreign service officers said that the most important attribute of a great ambassador was to be the expert on the country in which he or she was serving. To know the culture, the history, the language, subtleties of the political system. And my wife and I took that on with great relish, to try to be the persons in the embassy that best understood the Swiss history and culture. And the mission was different, was to change the way your host country people understood the United States. When we went over to Switzerland, their perception of our environmental policy, the favorable of the policy there was 4%. They were very negative on the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the death penalty, U.S. inaction on environmental issues for at least a generation, and much, much more. And so the number one mission that we had from the State Department, from Secretary Clinton, was to go over there and try as best we could to change the way the Swiss people understood the United States in a positive way. We had a chance to meet with President Obama just before we left with a group of ambassadors, and he said, here's what I want you to do. Listen, learn, and lead. And we put that in our pocket. So three pieces of public diplomacy. The first was listening, learning. Right away, you know, as Paul mentioned, I had been in statewide politics in Virginia for a long, long time. So you tend to bring to any job the history and experience you've had. So we approached public diplomacy as if it were a campaign. And we started with noting that there were 26 cantons in Switzerland and made a pledge right away to visit all 26 cantons, unaware that no one had ever made that pledge before. And they followed it day by day, canton by canton. We then moved it to the 156 distrettes or bezirkes, which are the subsets of the cantons. I think I made it to 112 of those, but it was a good effort. And trying everywhere to be accessible, to go to the classrooms and the pensions and the hikes and every place that you wouldn't typically expect to see an American ambassador. Remember in 2010, we were high up on a little mountain not far from Bern called the Hogan, and with a group of Americans. And as we're maybe 300 feet from the top, there's a couple of Swiss coming down, and they commented that they had never seen an American that high before. And that was a good thing, because the word carried. So with apologies to history and David Letterman, here are the top 25 things that I learned from Switzerland that might be useful in the USA. Number one, concordance politics. They do everything with a history of what they call shared power. The Swiss Federal Council, they're the only nation in the world that doesn't have a head of state. Their Federal Council is 7 members, right now from 5 different parties, and they do everything by consensus. They often note that things move slowly, but they do things together. Rather than the bicameral system that we have here, the two-party system, where one party has to win and the other party has to lose, and we fight, and we don't talk. There, everyone has to be together in order to make things happen. This is true not just at the federal council level, but in canton after canton and village after village. The canton of Aargau, which is halfway between Bern and Zurich, has a five-person cantonal government, five different parties from the left to the right, and they do everything by consensus. It's a very different system from ours, and I frankly like it. Number two, a balanced budget. They did their equivalent of a balanced budget amendment perhaps 6 years ago, called the debt limit, debt rate limit. And it's, again, it's a 2 or 3 year process. It's not every year, but the 4 years they were there, they ran surpluses of $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion, and $2 billion francs. No debt. Number three, they're number one in education spending in the world. And that has a very big impact on their ability to hold down unemployment, to train people for the jobs that are actually there. We have a senior at Brown and a freshman at Rice University right now, which means that I'm paying about 100 times per year what they would do for a Swiss education. 1,000 francs per year to go to the University of Zurich or University of Geneva or ETH. Number four is next year they will be 500 years since their last external battle. 1515, the Battle of Marignano. They did let Napoleon come in without a battle. They felt that was the smarter thing to do. They had a two-day civil war, Catholics versus Protestants, in 1847. Immediately decided after 50 people died, this was stupid, and moved to adopt a new constitution. I asked them whether they were going to have a big celebration next year, the 500th anniversary of their last external battle. They said no, because they lost the Battle of Marignano. Number five, their carbon footprint is one-third what ours is in the United States. One-third, and yet you cannot argue that they don't have a standard of living just as good or better than ours. We don't have to spend as much money on energy as we're spending now, or much time and much carbon dioxide, to have a good life. I was very impressed by their land use plan. If you fly over the eastern United States from Richmond to Boston, it's essentially nonstop housing complexes. In Switzerland, they got the idea that you can't do land use planning village by village, but rather as a country, or at least as a canton. They have an open space and village and open space and village, which then led to the seventh great advantage, is they have a train system that actually works. When you have density, you can make mass transit work. And they are the number one train riders in the world in train miles per person per year. Their savings rate is extraordinarily low. There's no family debt. Litigiousness is extraordinarily different from in the United States. I don't want to say anything unkind about trial lawyers, but in Switzerland, they're much more reluctant to take a case to court than they are to work it out themselves. I spent 15 years in the United States in Virginia working on high school dropout prevention before going overseas. Virginia's high school dropout rate is 27%. That's about the national average between the beginning of ninth grade and the end of 12th grade. These are folks who are doomed to a much lower income the rest of their lives, much lower job prospects. In Switzerland, the dropout rate is 1%, a dramatic difference. I keep wondering what our economy would be like and what our society would be like if we could have that 1%. Hand in hand with that is teen pregnancy. I was for many years on the board of the DC campaign to prevent teen pregnancy. Here in this city, the statistics are a little better now, but all through the 2000s, girls aged 15 to 19, 15% would be pregnant unintentionally every year in the city. You multiply that out, that means roughly deduped 75% of DC teenage girls would have an unintentional pregnancy during their teen years. It is a tragedy, again, compared to Switzerland, where it was virtually unheard of. Export orientation, the Swiss export 7 times per person the GDP that we do here in the United States. It gives them a much greater flexibility and diversity. I discovered that perhaps the thing I like best about living in Switzerland was that everything's closed on Sunday. And having a bunch of businesses that are of my own that are open on Sunday, this is a great advantage. I think it added years to our lives. And what they do on Sunday is church, a big meal, and then everyone walks for 4 hours, which means that everyone's thin. Language capabilities, you didn't have to have a graduate education to speak 3 or 4 languages. Every kid did. Multi-generational family businesses. The Swiss businesses I visited typically were fourth generation, fifth generation. I went to see the Beyer watch company, Beyer Chronometry, on the Bahnhofstrasse in Zurich. It's eighth generation. We looked for a family connection. We couldn't find it. No school consolidation. Every village still has their own elementary school. So therefore, no school buses. Kids walk to school, they walk home. No factory farms. There are 64,000 farms in Switzerland, and not a one of them is the kind of factory farm that you would find in downstate Virginia, for example, or Maryland's Eastern Shore. Five-bar cell service everywhere. Somehow they've overcome the reluctance of wealthy communities to put up cell phone towers. So even on the top of mountains or in the middle of the tunnels, you have five-bar cell service. Bike lanes, no trucks on Sundays, crosswalks. There's so many things that we learned there that we'd love to bring back to Virginia and to the United States. But the second big piece of public diplomacy is also telling our story, talking to them about the United States and helping them understand the wonderful strengths and the wonderful things that we do. And I thought it worked best when we just told stories. You know, not here are our policy prescriptions, but in with all the newspapers and the schools and the universities, with all the mayors, to talk about what we did in a story context. For example, it was fun and important to tell them the story about American foreign aid, that we spend more on foreign aid than every other nation in the world combined, and that with PEPFAR, you know, AIDS, TB, malaria, that the impact that we have on the number of people who go to bed hungry every night, the number of people who've been lifted out of poverty in the last 10 years, the smaller, ever smaller number of people killed in violence around the world, that as Americans, we're making a greater difference than any other nation, and we should be. To talk to them about immigration. Switzerland, like most of Europe, struggles with what do you do with people of color, or just people from Romania and Bulgaria. And to be able to come back and say, in our family business, only three generations, and more than half the people were born overseas. And that whether they're from Sri Lanka, or Vietnam, or El Salvador, or Russia, they're all marrying each other, they're all having children, they're all assimilating into America. All their kids are proud to be Americans. And that we then provide a wonderful role model for the rest of the nation, rest of the world, and how immigration and consolidation and assimilation can work. We had all the major Swiss environmentalists come to our home just before the COP15 convention in December of 2009 to talk about climate change, to talk about what the U.S. was doing. Most were astonished that we were doing anything, because the typical European press experience is the number one energy consumers per person in the world. So for them to find out that we have taken CAFE standards from 22 miles per gallon to 36 miles per gallon and then to 54 was stunning. Or for them to learn that we have 14,000 environmental NGOs in the United States all working on climate change. Or that dozens and dozens of cities adopted the Kyoto standards. That we have an enormous million, tens of millions of dollars going on in carbon research. All that the Obama administration has done with power plant restrictions. These were really important stories to tell. It changed their perspective on what we're doing to lead on environmental issues. Now, it was fun and important for us to talk about the role of women in the American economy. The Swiss didn't give women the right to vote until 1972. And the last canton didn't give women the right to vote, Appenzell Innerrhoden, until 1991, which is a long time. And when I first went over there, one of the earlier Swiss ambassadors sent me a list of the 167 most important people in Switzerland, and there was not a single woman on the list. We discovered that the women in Switzerland that were in leadership, to the person, had spent a good part of their career in the United States first. So we spent a lot of time talking about not just Hillary Clinton, but the leaders of Pepsi and General Motors and Yahoo and many other places, that in America, we're not perfect, but we're way ahead of most of Europe in terms of putting women, allowing women to come into their own in politics, in business, and in society, and that is a really good thing for the economy. We talk about birth rate a lot. The babies make us stronger. One of the things the Swiss reporters will always ask when you get there, you know, what do you like the most? And then what's your greatest surprise? And I, probably not very diplomatically, said that my greatest surprise was how everybody smokes. Because it's difficult to come to the United States in a and a college-educated group of friends to find anybody that smokes. And so we try to use that as a teaching opportunity also. That, yes, you may be number two in the world in longevity, but just think where you'd be if you didn't smoke. Overall, we tried to overcome the storyline that the U.S. is constantly at war, constantly over-consuming global energy resources, executing our prisoners, and we're fat. And I think we made some progress. The third big piece, though, of public diplomacy is the relationship building. I've always been enamored of the old, everybody in the world's connected to Kevin Bacon by no more than seven people. And in the 9.5 years that I was campaigning statewide in Virginia, I had a little project where everyone I would meet in Virginia, Roanoke, Big Stone Gap, or Emporia, at the drive-through window at McDonald's, I'd talk to them for a minute and see if we could find a common friend. And this is not an exaggeration. In 9.5 years, I never found one person that we couldn't find a common friend within 5 minutes. Which is to say, I was connected to every person in Virginia by no more than one degree of separation. Well, we go to Switzerland and assume that it's right back up to seven. But if we can get it down to five or three or two and begin to get everybody on the same interconnectedness, the same network, then it would be a wonderful thing for public diplomacy. Because yes, we learn through stories, but we also learn through friendships, the people who are the role models for us. So we set out to know first, obviously, every member of the seven-person Federal Council, and then their chiefs of staff over for dinner. And then I would visit every member of Parliament, as many as I could, not just in Parliament, but in their home communities where they could, you know, be the big dog and show off their communities. And then the editors of all the newspapers and the radio stations and the TV stations, business leaders, restaurant owners, professors, climbing guides, fitness instructors, every person that we could talk to and meet and create a human connection with was another critical investment in our public diplomacy. For me, one of the small highlights was in October of 2012. We had lunch with the mayor of Zermatt up at the highest border station in Europe, right on the just below the Matterhorn, where the falls down to Cervinia in Italy. And we get to talking and we find out that we have at least 11 friends in common. So after 3 years, when the mayor of Zermatt and I are that close, I figure, you know, we're making progress. I had lunch, one of those 3-hour lunches with all five members of the cantonal government in Europe, which was the brave canton that took the two Uyghurs out of Guantanamo that no other nation would touch because they were afraid to offend the Chinese. And at the end of the 3-hour lunch, I asked the five members of the Canton Europe if they, in fact, knew every person in Europe. They said, among the five of us, we absolutely do, all 35,000 members. I said, well, good, now I am connected to every member of Canton Europe by one degree of separation. Now, this is also the downside of the 3-year terms. When we engaged in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they changed the length of the average foreign service. As Harry knows, it used to be often was 4 years. But since they were doing linked assignments, if they wanted you to go to Baghdad, they had to promise you burn. They shortened those. And 3 years is really not long enough. Most of the other ambassadors there had been there 4 years. The dean was Per Torsen from Sweden, who'd been there 6 years. Not accidentally, he was the best known ambassador in the country, had the best relationships with the most number of people, because he had time to do it. Mike McFaul is coming home from Moscow after 2 years. John Huntsman came home from Beijing after 2 years. Tim Romer from New Delhi after 2 years. That's not long enough to even begin to make an impact in public diplomacy and to begin the relationships that can really resound. You know, people get their knowledge and impressions from many, many sources, but meaningful friendships and meaningful relationships really make a difference. I know Paul on the American Security Project list of public diplomacy priorities for 2013 talk about merging the analog and the digital. So yes, we try to have a good tweet presence and a good Facebook presence and to work the social media, but social media is so much more effective if you have the personal relationship that go on top of it. So public diplomacy. First is understanding the Swiss story as best you can. Second, telling the American story as best you can. And third, making it all come alive with real human relationships. I love the experience. I highly recommend it. I don't expect to have anything like this ever happen to me again in my whole life. I don't intend to retire, but but it was something that I'll always treasure. And just the chance to go there and to represent the United States of America, Democrats and Republicans alike, was a great honor. I'd love to take your questions, even Paul's, and thank you very much for coming to lunch.
Yeah. As Chairman Chabal, I'm going to ask the first question. Switzerland had a referendum on Sunday about immigration, and it's greatly affected its relationship with the EU. What are your views on why it happened, what's going to go on from now on?
The referendum on Sunday was the referendum to end mass immigration. And if you get a chance to see the posters on the internet, they're pretty scary. They're very reminiscent of 1930s Germany. You know, black and white and fairly frightening, intended to be frightening. This is the third or fourth in a series of initiatives and referendums from the Swiss People's Party, which is the conservative, you know, farther right party in Swiss politics, led by a long time by a man named Christoph Blocher. They have discovered that by playing on people's fears, by playing on a concern about disappearing Swissness, that is the noun, that they can get more votes and slowly build a majority. That's what they hope. I think they're pretty close to the plurality party in Virginia, but now we're close to a majority. Some years ago, perhaps 4 years ago, there was another initiative on immigration that had a bunch of white sheep and a black sheep, and they were throwing the black sheep out. 2 years ago, the big initiative was on deporting people, foreigners, you know, people that were not citizens, who had broken laws in Switzerland. This one was about limiting immigration overall. And there was also one in 2009 from the same Swiss People's Party on not building minarets. There were 4 minarets in Switzerland. They didn't want it anymore. The fear was that minarets would overcome the crosses above the churches. Somehow you would be able to see the Alps with the minarets. What's been interesting in all the initiatives, some of which have passed, some of which have failed, is that the vote tolls are coming overwhelmingly from rural Switzerland, from places like Graubünden, where there are typically no immigrants and no minarets, but where the fear of that is very high. And they've been soundly defeated in Zurich, Basel, Geneva, and Bern, where the immigrants live, where the 4 minarets that actually were there. It's a politics of fear, and it works. There is some basis for it, too, in the sense that you get 70,000 people a year additional into a country with only 8 million. The trains get longer. The trains get more crowded. The traffic congestion is worse. Unfortunately, the Swiss People's Party will argue that the criminal justice system, the corrections particularly, and the social services network are now dominated by, the resources are used by immigrants rather than people that were third, fourth, and fifth generation Swiss. So there's a natural pushback against people coming, especially from Northern Africa, Nigeria, and from farther Eastern Europe, Romania, Bulgaria in particular. It's complicated for the Swiss because this is a departure from the Schengen Agreement on the free movement of people. And the rest of Europe, which is struggling with exactly the same issues, how to treat all these immigrants coming into France and Germany and the Netherlands, don't want Switzerland to have that particular advantage of being able to restrict immigration when they can't. They don't feel that it's a level playing field. The EU doesn't want Switzerland to pick and choose what parts of the EU compact it wants to agree to and which parts it doesn't want to. So it's going to lead to a very difficult discussion. A key part of remembering this, though, is that the passage of the referendum by 50.3% on Sunday, the Federal Council, which urged the people to vote no on the referendum, still has 3 years to turn it into law. And that 3 years will be critical in working with the EU and implementing it in a way that doesn't jeopardize the status. EU is by far the largest trading partner of Switzerland, so they can't afford not to still have good relations.
Thank you. I'm going to explain it. We've got a microphone.
Thanks.
If you just tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Hennick. I'm a Foreign Service Officer at the State Department. Thank you for your service, Mr. Ambassador, and for your remarks. One of the things that I think would fall under that last category you mentioned, relationships when we're talking about public diplomacy, but you didn't specifically mention, I was hoping you might be able to share some personal anecdotes about, is the effectiveness of actual exchange programs. You know, our programs that bring, you know, Europeans, including Swiss, to the United States, and similarly bring Americans to Switzerland. Can you comment on the effectiveness of
that? Thank you, John. It's a great point. And I didn't mention it only because we had so few. And part of the shift to Asia is that a lot of the international visitor programs were moving that direction. I think we had 2 per year in Switzerland, and we usually begged it up to 4. However, the 4 we got for 8 million people were usually very well used. We were trying to find the people that we thought were going to be the greatest influence leaders in Switzerland in the years to come. And the 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks that they would spend in the United States would usually dramatically change their perspective on the U.S. and then seeded goodwill for us back in Switzerland. And certainly we had 6,000 people come through our home in 4 years, 468 overnight house guests. So we brought as many Americans to Switzerland as we could to share their perspectives and to build those relationships. I would love to see many, many, many more of those exchange programs, including the Fulbrights. But I think we also had to be realistic and say the American priority was not Switzerland, but was the Arab world, was the Pacific, and a lot of other places.
Mr. Ambassador, Harry Blaney, Center for International Policy. I'd like to go back to this, what's happening in Switzerland, and look beyond Switzerland with respect to what I'll call an inward-turning, often racist, conservative move, and to use immigration as a tool to, in effect, win political power. About, I guess it was 2001. So, I did an article for the Washington Post Outlook section on right-wing parties in Europe, and I had served in Europe a number of times, and the thing that I was trying to look at was the similarities of the societies of different countries. I didn't really focus a lot on Switzerland at that time. It seems that those things have grown rather than not. And the particularism and nativistic elements that are at work seem not only to be based on keeping the strangers out, but also a antipathy to the idea of the unity of Europe as such. And I'd like you to think about how you look on that beyond it. But then also from a policy prescriptive way, what can we as Americans, given our history that you described, and I think quite nicely, what can we do that makes it clear that we're on the side of inclusiveness and openness and participation when we have often in the United States, as you know, a serious debate about those very issues ourselves?
Harry, those are very hard questions, and I wish I had more wisdom. But I think you're right, that an awful lot of the perceived racism and the exclusionary part of it is not maybe even a base about that, but rather as a political strategy to gain power. Lucy Staam, who's the member of parliament who led that initiative, I know him pretty well, and he doesn't seem like a particularly mean-spirited racist person at all. But he is a member of a political party that would love to be dominant, that would love to have more than one member on the federal council out of 7. And this was a path to victory. I hope this isn't an odious comparison, but it strikes me as reminiscent of the Southern strategy that Richard Nixon pointed out after Voting Rights Act. I know a lot of people who have benefited from that Southern strategy who are not racist and would never want to be described as racist. But it nevertheless brought them to political power, state by state. Where we go from it, I love the idea of continuing to project the American example. But I felt so blessed to be surrounded by wonderful career foreign service officers the 4 years I was there. People who will be friends the rest of my life, who I have enormous respect for, who taught me and supported me and were all the complicated bank secrecy stuff and Iran sanction stuff. But one of the things we struggled with was trying to build out a foreign affairs team from the U.S. State Department that was of color. Very difficult to find the African Americans. There were just so few that were there. Women were a little bit easier, but the president has done a great job of trying to make his administration look like America. And we need to continue to try to do a great job to make the American Foreign Service look like America too.
Mr. Ambassador, I'm Charles Newstead from the State Department, but I hesitate to add, I hasten to add, that I'm not here in any official capacity, just representing myself. And someone told me that you have an interest in science. And since, of course, as you know, in Geneva, you have that world famous laboratory called CERN, I just wondered what your interactions were with that and how you thought America could even increase its relationship with the people at CERN.
I was looking at your white State Department badge jealously. They took mine away. of all the wonderful experiences I had in Switzerland, the highlight was having lunch at CERN with the director and the director of research, and having 2 hours with the smartest people in the world to talk about dark energy and dark matter and why the asymmetry of matter and antimatter. So what I think is very important, by the way, I think half of CERN are American scientists. So even though we didn't build a collider in Texas, I think we still got our collider. We tried to bring over as many prominent scientists as we could to meet with Swiss scientists. For example, Craig Venter, who was very integral, he would say, the leader of the Human Genome Project, came a couple of times, and we invited not only every biology professor we could find of the universities in Switzerland, but all the leading scientists from the pharmaceutical industry and others. And they loved having Craig there. The head of the genetics department at Harvard, George Church, also my cousin, we brought George over and surrounded him with the best geneticists we could find in Switzerland, who again just loved it. Any opportunity we had to bring American scientists there was a great way to talk about everything that we're doing here and to showcase American brilliance, American ingenuity. As a quick pivot too, by the way, one of the downsides of Swiss culture is they have no tolerance for failure. If you start a business and fail, that's it. You're an employee for somebody else the rest of your life. As opposed to America, where we're allowed to fail many times and fall down 6 times, get up 7. And I'd love to tell the story of the senior senator from Virginia, Mark Warner, who went broke twice before finally hitting on Nextel and doing very well. And so we did lots of exchanges with Swiss entrepreneurs to the United States for 6 weeks or 3 months to see what that entrepreneurial culture here is like, and try to bring that back there.
I'm going to ask one more question, which is, how does an ambassador help job creation here?
In a number of ways. At least, I'm sure if I were in India or China, there would be many more ways that I would be able to talk about. But for us, it was first and foremost direct investment. And not all this is actually Swiss money, but it's money in Swiss banks controlled by Swiss bankers and Swiss money managers. So the money's coming from the Middle East, coming from India. A lot of it came from Greece the last couple of years. And they would have to put it someplace where it could earn money. So we would do our best to link it to investments in the United States. Second was export controls. And happily, one of the initiatives that the president started at the Department of Commerce, Defense, State Together, was looking at all the items that are part of export control now and revising it to make sense today. And that, for companies like Honeywell, it had an enormous impact to rationalize those rules. And the third would be reducing the non-tariff barriers. In my real life before politics and ambassador, I sell cars. And one of the challenges there is I brought a new Volvo over that cost $35,000 here in the United States. And I saw the identical car for 89,000 Swiss francs, which is more than $90,000. So you have a very protected market. And so we were doing a lot, not for personal gain, but to try to open up that market for used cars to make them more affordable in Switzerland and to create export opportunities for wholesalers here in the United States.
Sorry. My name is Erin Tucker and I'm with Dentons. I just wanted to say that I spent 4 years of my undergrad in Switzerland, so hearing you speak was very wonderful to kind of reminisce of my college. I wanted to know your opinion. I know President Obama has taken new initiatives with Iran, in particular to their nuclear program, and I wanted to see what you thought about the Swiss and Iran sanctions moving forward and where you see possible issues or conflicts arising.
I hope you enjoyed the 4 years. And if you have any disagreements, please, or different perspectives on it, that those are welcome. Switzerland, you probably all know this, but Switzerland represents the United States in Iran. We're the protecting power. It happened since 1981, a year or so after the embassy was closed. One of the ironies, I think, of American-Iranian relations is that all through the Cold War, when we had 10,000 nuclear weapons aimed at the Soviet Union, they had 10,000 aimed at us, we always had an embassy in Moscow. And we always had cultural exchanges and musical exchanges and student exchanges and conversations. Sometimes I'm sure overheard conversations, as Victoria Nuland might mention. yet in Iran, we've had none of that through the Swiss. The Swiss have been very eager to be helpful in rebuilding the relationship between the United States and it's not been easy for them. They did enormous hard work trying to get the three hikers who were caught or arrested. Some would say not even in Iran back in the late summer of 2009, but brought them home. I don't know the role that the Swiss played in the agreement that John Kerry has forged with Iran, the 6 month. Tony Bakken and Rich Smith and opening up for ADA inspections and $6 billion worth of sanctions relief and the like. I do know that what we tried to do the 4 years I was there was use a non-military weapon, a non-military tool, sanctions, to bring the Iranians to the bargaining table. And now that we finally have, and we have an interim agreement, that we need to do everything we can to let the agreement work. I am very much opposed to the Menendez legislation. And I thought the president was very eloquent in the State of the Union address, trying to let the agreement work. If it doesn't work, it's going to be very bad for Iran and very bad for world peace. But my God, we have to let them drop.
I'm Bruce Gregory of George Washington University. You touched briefly on the use of social media. Could you elaborate a bit more on that in terms of your own use of social media, the attitudes of the embassy staff, its strengths and limitations?
How old do you think I am, Professor? I'm 63. That's not a fair question. We tried hard. I don't think we were very good at it. But let me back up one thing. I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings, but the U.S. government's stranglehold on website development is really painful. The difference between doing website development in the U.S. Embassy and all the restrictions that you have is so different from what we would have in private business that it was very, very slow, very difficult. 30 minutes to upload a picture, just craziness. Having said that, we also did our best to try to have a vibrant Twitter presence, a vibrant Facebook presence. But our public affairs officer was 45. We would tend to hire the spouses of the younger Foreign Service officers who are a little hipper. When I come back and see what we're doing in the United States, what we do just in the family business, dramatically better here. And maybe as we get younger Foreign Service officers, maybe even public affairs cone folks that are specialized in social media, it will grow. Because it is really critical. I am continually amazed at how our children can use Facebook and Twitter to communicate with tens of thousands of people in minutes that would take us months or years.
Henry Hacker, Research and Merit. Ms. Ambassador, thanks for this excellent presentation. Speaking of Switzerland, I noticed on one of these foreign news stations recently some illustrations, pictorials of Switzerland's new giant lakes have been formed by global warming, a great melting of glaciers, something that has never happened before. So they have these new marvelous lakes of relatively cold water. However, fresh water, there's a lot of water available. I contacted Nestle, a big company in Switzerland that deals in bottled water. I remember seeing a lot of negative publicity on the news regarding the state of Maine and some communities where they felt there was too much water being taken that should really be for their utilization, not for a company that would export it, the water somewhere else. So I thought regarding Nestle, perhaps they could look into Greenland and take apart some of the Greenland ice sheet, which is, of course, fresh water, and utilize that and reduce the danger that it would melt in time due to global warming and cause a large flood, you know, worldwide. So this is how some scientists have talked, this concern, but they've received the information, but they've never responded. They haven't responded either positively or negatively. But it's clearly a place where a bottling plant could be built with some difficulty. And to use the ice sheet there. In Finland, they have been doing this in the Gulf of Botnia and using icebergs as a source of water. So I wondered, what are your feelings on something like this?
It sounds fascinating. I never thought about that before. One of the things I can comment on, though, is that it is an enormous concern in Switzerland, as in much of the rest of the world, about global warming. And you see it there. I remember spending one afternoon, we're actually in Chamonix, France, just over the border, waiting for some friends to come down off Mont Blanc. And you could literally see the glacier melt in real time. Every 5 minutes, another big piece would cave off of it. You could go back weekend to weekend and see the glaciers retreat valley after valley. And they say in the US West, it may only be a couple feet a year, it would be hundreds of meters per year in Switzerland. I'm quickly moving back to when Hannibal drove the elephants through 2,000 years ago. Switzerland's greatest natural resource is its water. They virtually have nothing else, scenery and water. So it's a great concern for them to have this natural water base melt and perhaps flow downstream.
I think we've got time for one more question.
Sorry, but I have one kind of inside the beltway question, Ambassador. In your years at Switzerland, and talking to your fellow ambassadors, one of the great questions and debate within the Department of State is how the department and its resources and the way it communicates can really help in further the work of the ambassadors on the spot, and ways in which the ambassador can be better in terms of communicating their views and perspectives. A great classic case of this, of course, is George Kennan's long telegram in which he outlined essentially the containment policy towards Russia, which was read by everybody. And that was a feeding back, if you would, even though he thought it was misunderstood. So my question really is there some lessons, not only in public diplomacy, but in other areas, including how they can help you better, any efforts that were made to do that, and were they successful or not?
It was interesting to compare the long telegram with Mike McFaul's tweets and say how far we've come or not. I spent 4 years hoping that I'd write the next long telegram. I'm not sure that I got that done. But it was fun on occasion. There weren't that many opportunities to do something that felt that important or that elevated. One of the things that went on the whole time I was there was the U.S. Department of Justice suits against first UBS and then Credit Suisse et al. Over bank secrecy, over Americans cheating on their taxes by hiding assets in Swiss banks. And being able to write the cables or increasingly the emails rather than the cables because they got more readership on how Department of Justice actions would affect U.S.-Swiss relations, how it would affect the U.S. economy. Because, for example, Credit Suisse is bigger in the United States than Lehman Brothers was when it fell. And that UBS has way more employees in the United States than it has in Switzerland. Very interconnected global economy. And it was fun and important to be able to think about the actual policy ramifications and the economic ramifications of other efforts that different parts of the United States government is making. But one of the things I was warned about early on, and this, I don't know if this is true, is that so many cables are like strategic plans that are written but never read. So trying to find ways to get them written in a way that the right people will read them and then act on them, or at least integrate them into their thinking, was the challenge. I usually found follow-up phone calls were good. I just sent you this email. Please read it.
Or you write a cable and then attach it to an email.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. And
depending on the snow level that we will get on Wednesday and Thursday, we'll have a breakfast event on Thursday on Syria and what is happening in Aleppo, and a lunchtime event on Egypt and the political economic transformations there. But, Mr. Ambassador, thank you again. It's been wonderful.